Welcome to the South Carolina Lead, a podcast that breaks down state political news for you and provides insight on legislative happenings under the Statehouse Dome in Columbia. Hello, I'm your host, Gavin Jackson, and this episode is for the week of June 13th, 2018. We dropped the podcast late this week since the primaries were on Tuesday. Yeah, remember those things that we've been talking about for, I don't know, all year? Well, they just happened, and I hope you voted, or God help me, I will come through this phone. The Lead is a podcast where we go beyond the headlines with reporters who wrote the stories affecting you. Every Tuesday, we give you a roundup of news, insight into the week's biggest stories, campaign trail intrigue, and a chaser of trivia. You can listen to all four sections while you wonder what IHOB was thinking with a temporary name change. And BTW, we're now SCLeadBob. Or what to do now since the primaries are over. Just kidding, there are runoffs to be held and a special session all before the end of the month and our summer hiatus. And now, quorum call. Quorum call is a term to see if there's a majority present, but here in the South Carolina Lead, we know a majority of the time that you're not always current with the news. So here's a quick recap of several top stories you should know about. And just an FYI, the campaign trail is our main discussion today, but stay tuned afterwards for Did You Know with the Russ McKinney and myself. Number one, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers announced $49 million in funding for the Charleston Harbor Deepening Project. Construction to deepen the Charleston Harbor entrance channel began in February following the awarding of the first two dredging contracts. Now, this money comes in combination with a $50 million loan expected in the pending state budget to deepen the harbor to the Wando Welch Terminal by early 2021. Now, state lawmakers previously set aside $271 million for the $558 million project. So far, the federal government has only contributed $66.5 million of the $287 million it's responsible for. Number two, the Post and Courier reports that South Carolina's suicide rate increased more than 38% between 1999 and 2016. That's a larger jump than any other state in the Southeast, according to new federal data. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report shows an average 17.7 people per 100,000 committed suicide in South Carolina between 2014 and 2016. Suicide is the 10th leading cause of death in the United States, and only one of three leading causes that continues to climb. People struggling with unhealthy thoughts should seek company and avoid isolation. The National Suicide Prevention Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. It's 1-800-273-8255. It's free, confidential, and available 24 hours a day. Number three, fraternity and sorority violations at the University of South Carolina are down 18% from the previous academic year. This according to disciplinary records reported by the state newspaper. USC cited 8 fraternities and 2 sororities with 23 violations in the past academic year. That's down from 28 violations in the previous year, which was the highest number of violations since at least 2011 when recording began. Hazing and alcohol violations were the most cited. And finally, the Hill newspaper reports that Republican South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham said any agreement between the United States and North Korea that comes from President Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un should come to Congress for approval. He said, quote, "Not only do I want to see the details, I want to vote on them," quote, as he said on NBC's Today Show. He also signaled some doubt about the details of the denuclearization agreement Trump achieved with Kim. Trump met Tuesday in Singapore with Kim, marking the first summit between sitting leaders of the United States and North Korea. And once again, we parried the Lieb. See what we did there, IHOP? No one wants your steak burgers, you flophouse. Hello and welcome to the soundtrack of your post-primary night hangover. We got a lot to talk about, several big stories, including incumbent 1st District Congressman Mark Sanford's defeat, Governor Henry McMaster and upstate businessman John Warren heading to the June 26 runoff, leaving Catherine Templeton behind. James Smith cruises to the Democratic gubernatorial nomination. State Senator William Timmons and former State Senator Lee Bright are also in a runoff for the 4th congressional seat. Attorney General Alan Wilson is also in a runoff with State Rep. Todd Atwater. lots to talk about here. That's why we brought in our campaign trail guide, the Post and Courier's Jamie Lovegrove, and of course, Meg Kennard with the Associated Press, who covers the state of South Carolina with us as well. Hey, Meg.
Hello, how are you?
So let's just jump right into this. Meg, we saw Mark Sanford's narrow loss yesterday. It became quite a national story. Why did this blow up so big? What was the big deal there?
I mean, Mark Sanford is the comeback kid of South Carolina. He is the guy who had never, up until yesterday, never lost a race and had been able to come back from what, for many other candidates, would have been completely insurmountable things to happen to him. The Appalachian Trail situation, which we probably don't need to go into too much detail on, but that would have just been a nail in the coffin for a lot of politicians.
Yep.
Not only did Mark Sanford not resign during all of that, he filled out the rest of his term as governor. And then, lo and behold, a couple years later, got reelected to the House of Representatives in the seat he had been in before he became governor.
Mm-hmm.
So he came through all of that. He got his old seat back. And in the end, it was his, at least, you know, for Katie Arrington having been successful in that race last night, it was his inability, his unwillingness to, at least in the way she framed it, go along with Donald Trump and be on the side of the president for a lot of the messaging that took place in that race.
And we're talking about, again, first-term state rep Katie Arrington from Somerville, who has dethroned somewhat of a giant here in politics in South Carolina. Jimmy, what did you see in that race, and what's your takeaway on it?
It is a shot across the bow to every Republican member of Congress that has not already chosen to resign voluntarily, that if you are going to cross this president, barring a few districts out there, there are a few districts out there that are still more moderate, but in many, many Republican districts around the country, that's just not acceptable anymore. And the defense that you are voting with him a lot of the time just is not going to save you. It's an interesting comparison to this is in the Senate, folks like Jeff Flake, folks like Bob Corker, they've been voting with Trump most of the time as well. You know who hasn't been voting with Trump a lot of the time has been Rand Paul. But Rand Paul doesn't go on TV and bash the president on CNN and criticize his rhetoric and criticize his tone. And that's actually what disturbs the president and what rankles him a lot more than whether you're going to vote with him on some bill that he probably doesn't care all that passionately about anyway.
I think the last time that we looked up, you know, the averages of how many times Sanford had been voting with Trump, it was above 70%.
Yeah, 80, something like that.
Yeah. And so for, you know, like Jamie was saying, if anybody's really paying attention to that stuff, well, those are pretty good numbers.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
If we're dealing with the administration we're dealing with,
the TV
stuff and the TV criticism is going to speak
and,
a lot
And
louder.
The same with voters. I mean, I think there are a lot of Trump voters that they're not paying attention to every bill that comes in before Congress, but they do see when their member of Congress is on CNN, you know, openly disagreeing with the president, and they're just not okay with that.
And that was huge in Arrington's advertising, too, really hitting on those things. Even though, you know, Sanford was pretty critical to passing those tax cuts and was part of the House Freedom Caucus, you know, we have a quote from Sanford from last night, his concession speech. He said, it may have cost me an election in this case, but I stand by every one of those decisions to disagree with the president. I mean, do you have to give Sanford some credit for not deciding to resign and to face this challenge head on, just like some of these other people in races across the country?
Look, he knew from the very beginning that this was going to make things more difficult. You know, he was given interviews as far back as February 2017 saying, I know the things that I'm saying now and the things that I'm probably going to continue to say over the next year if Trump doesn't change are going to make my reelection more difficult. But I'm just not going to change who I am. And that's very characteristic of Mark Sanford. Of course, he's never been the kind of guy who is willing to bow to political pressure on all types of issues.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he probably assumed, like a lot of us, that he is electorally near invincible. And he's certainly proven that over the course of his 24-year career. But this was just one move too far.
It is 2018. Things are changing.
and it's that exact attitude, that unwillingness to waver, that ability to continually reiterate the same message over and over that made Sanford so popular, especially during his first go-around in the U.S. House back in the 90s. People really admired him for that stick-to-itiveness that he has had and exhibited as governor. And, you know, he's fiscal conservative and all the attributes that you just mentioned. in any other political environment, that would endear the voters to him more and more. But we're in a whole new age where that doesn't really seem to cut it anymore. And that age doesn't include Mark Sanford now.
And just to get on to the next race here, Arrington will go on to face Democrat Joe Cunningham in November. Cunningham won his Democratic primary last night. Really quick, any takeaways from that? And are we going to see national money coming in from DCCC, other groups like that?
In a weird way, the silver lining for Democrats in South Carolina of the Archie Parnell situation with his domestic violence history coming out and the DCCC dropping him as a candidate, the South Carolina Democratic Party saying they're calling on him to drop out. I talked to both of them. They're saying they're not changing that position just because he's the nominee. They are calling on him to drop out. As a result of that, all the resources are going to go to the 1st District. I also thought maybe there was a chance if Bill Hopkins won in the 7th District, some more money would go there, but he didn't make it to the runoff last night. So I think really the big focus for Democrats in South Carolina is going to be in that 1st Congressional District, and I expect that's going to make a lot of noise as we lead up to November.
There is going to be a little bit of a necessary strategy shift, though, because the Democrats had been preparing for quite some time to run against Mark Sanford.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Clearly, they're not going to be able to in this go-around, but you know that will be something that they're going to have to kind of switch gears on.
We did
start
to see in the very final few weeks, clearly Joe Cunningham's team, I think, started to also think they might be facing Arrington. They started directing a lot more attention towards her. They started talking about offshore drilling, which she was kind of noncommittal on. They were getting ready, and I think there were pros and cons for them of facing each of the two prospective Republicans, but it is a very different race now, for sure.
And Jamie, you were up in Greenville last night covering John Warren, the gubernatorial mm-hmm. race, and then also the 13-member GOP field for the open 4th Congressional District race. What happened last night? What can you fill us in on in terms of that huge field that is now whittled down to two?
That was obviously a very crowded field. Lee Bright had always been the favorite to make the runoff just because he was unique among all of the other candidates and that he did have sort of a built-in reputation mm-hmm. as a conservative firebrand from his years in the state Senate. He had a lot of name ID in the district. But folks always said about him, analysts, strategists, and you can take this with a grain of salt, but their claim was always he has a high floor and a low ceiling, that he was very likely to make the runoff from the get-go, but he's going to have a very hard time winning it. A lot of the candidates who were running for that second runoff spot are a lot more similar. It really came down at the end of the day to State Senator William Timmons, who ended up getting it, State Representative Dan Hamilton, and former Spartanburg GOP Chairman Josh Kimbrell. Timmons ended up squeaking it out. We'll still see a recount in that race, I think, because it's within 1%. But there is going to be absolutely unfathomable amounts of money, I think, pouring yeah. into that race because there are business groups that will do anything, both in South Carolina and nationally, to make sure that Lee Bright does not make it to Congress. So it's going to become a very interesting next 2 weeks up there.
When you look at the numbers in the governor's race and also in the 4th district, mm-hmm. and you look at who came out at the top of the ticket and then the people who came underneath them, when you add up those underneath numbers, they are astronomically larger than that first place finisher. Lee Bright got, what, just over a quarter of the votes cast from the last tallies that I looked at. But adding up those next three finishers, those next three candidates who are very similar and who are going to draw from very similar voter pools, that's going to make this a pretty crazy runoff in 2 weeks.
And the state Republican Party announced a 4th Congressional District runoff debate for Monday, June 18th at 6:30 p.m. at the Greenville Hilton. I'm going to be up there. I know you guys all are going to be paying attention or going to be up there as well. Might be paying attention. I don't know.
Might be
hopefully.
Casually
asking questions.
Casually.
You know.
And it's also worth noting that Democrats in this race, Brandon Brown and Doris Lee Turner, will also face a runoff on June 26th. Mm-hmm. And then all of those guys are going to face American Party candidate Guy Ferrey in the general. So we'll see what comes out of that. Another House race we want to really touch on is the 5th Congressional District with Democrat Archie Parnell.
Yeah.
Admitted to abusing his ex-wife 45 years ago, won the Democratic nomination outright, will face incumbent Ralph Norman.
Yep. He, you know, as I wrote yesterday, before this election, he was always the overwhelming favorite to still yeah. pull it out. The three candidates he was running against were total unknowns. You know, before all of this came out, it was a foregone conclusion that he was going to be the nominee. You know, it's now going to be very, very difficult for them to pull this one out. Democrats have now become a lot more candid about this race in the aftermath of all this and said, you know what? We were probably overhyping the odds of winning it anyway. The fact of the matter is that the 5th Congressional District is still red. There was a special election last mm-hmm. year in which he fell by 3%, but, you know, the special election is very different
general.
Dynamic. So, you know, he'll certainly give it his all, and he's a very good campaigner, and he's very popular among Democrats in that district. But In terms of winning over some of the crossover votes he was probably going to need, it's going to be a little harder now.
And now to our prime event that we've all been covering, that we've all been looking forward to. We were all out last night covering the several candidates in the race. I was hanging out at Catherine Templeton's watch party for a little bit before I went to Henry McMaster's watch party where you were, Meg. Jamie, you were in the upstate with John Warren.
Yep.
A lot of things happened. I really want to get this one out of the way quickly first because this is the easiest one to talk about. Democrat James Smith, mm-hmm. Columbia representative, a lawyer, Kalmbach vet, and he's been in the State House for 22 years. Swept the Democratic field, as we all kind of expected. He defeated Charleston businessman Phil Noble, who got 11%, and Florence antitrust lawyer Marguerite Willis, who got 28%. And James Smith rounded out with 62%, more than enough to avoid a runoff outright. So he'll be campaigning, obviously, for the general election. But things changed over in the Republican race. We did see a runoff, of course, as we expected, because there was five of them there. But the big takeaway was that it's McMaster and John Warren now, and Catherine Templeton did not make the cut. Warren got about 28%, Templeton 21%, and McMaster at 42% of the vote. So pretty high scoring for McMaster. We all kind of anticipated him to be in somewhere in that range. Obviously, mm-hmm. we saw some recent polling and some new momentum from the Warren campaign. But someone told me last night that if this race, if this election would have happened a couple weeks ago, those numbers would have been drastically different, citing some major campaign momentum for the McMaster campaign. We saw him crisscrossing the state in a bus, plane tours, appearing on Fox News, just really blitzing, getting that groundswell to that 42%. What does he have to do next to keep this going in order to make sure that he keeps that margin and doesn't give too much away, especially when you look at the challengers who had been on his heels the entire time?
One thing that Henry McMaster is really going to need to do is continue to remind voters in all corners of the state that he is their guy. Even if they haven't elected him as their guy necessarily as governor before, he needs to continue to crisscross, to get out there, to shake hands, to be face-to-face with these voters. They love to see Henry McMaster do that. Frankly, and I've spoken with some campaign people about this previously, if he had made that kind of a push weeks and weeks ago, I think we would have seen those poll numbers or at least had the feeling of the numbers in the race, I think they would have been very different for him. Mm-hmm. South Carolinians, they know Henry McMaster. Clearly, he's been around for a while, but they like to see him energized and out there actually doing that campaign piece. You know, he's been governor, obviously. He's been busy. He's had a lot of things to do. But now that he's actually been hitting the trail very yeah. actively and getting out there and getting people excited and going to country music fests and yeah. getting on the bus and doing the campaign things that we expect to see for candidates to do, he's been doing that, and it pays off in terms of the numbers that showed out for him last night. So if he keeps that up, keeps that energy up, mm-hmm. then I think he has a good chance of continuing some of that momentum that he's been building up in the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, that's why I told his campaign yesterday. I'm like, you guys are going to be on a bus for the next 2 weeks, but that's not expected. It's runoffs. Things, I mean, we're in a pressure cooker right now, Jamie.
Yeah, well, you know, it's going to be a very interesting next couple of weeks. Look, it is hard for the incumbent to get much more of the vote than they did in the first round. That's always going to be tricky because all of the candidates, with maybe the exception of Yancey McGill, who only pulled in less than 2%, you know, their whole campaigns were based around opposition to Henry McMaster.
Yeah.
And it's hard to imagine, I'm sure they're out there, but it's hard to imagine there being large numbers of, say, Catherine Templeton supporters that are now going to turn around and say, you know what, Governor McMaster's not that bad. I'm going to go ahead and vote for him mm-hmm. over Warren, who ran a very similar message to Catherine Templeton, literally using some of these same phrases, you know, outdoing her on the conservative outsider label that she had been running on before he got into the race.
Mm-hmm.
I would expect Kevin Bryant also he may well throw his support behind John Warren. If not, I still expect a lot of his supporters who were kind of, I talked to quite a few folks up in the upstate yesterday, which is where both John Warren and Kevin Bryant are from.
Yeah.
And a lot of them were choosing between those two. You know, there were folks saying, I really like Kevin Bryant, but I'm not sure he can win, so I'm going to vote for John Warren. Or Tara Servatius, the conservative radio host up there, said, I'm going to reward Kevin Bryant for his work in the state Senate. I'm going to vote for him. So I think he can pick up a lot of votes there. You know, the question is just going to be, how is Governor McMaster going to find that 7.5-8% that he did not have last night? What kind of muddles all of this is we really have no idea what the actual electorate is going to look like in 2 weeks, because one would assume it is not going to be exactly the same as it was mm-hmm. last night. It could be lower. There could be folks who did not vote for John Warner, Henry Master, that don't vote 2 weeks from now. So it's pretty hard to predict, but, you know, you probably would have liked to see yourself a little closer to 50% if you're on the McMaster team.
And one interesting thing about watching the numbers come in last night, Greenville, the whole upstate, was very slow to report. All kinds of problems up there. But once those numbers started to come in, they cut away from the numbers that Henry McMaster had.
Yeah.
And a lot of those votes did turn out for Warren or turned out for somebody else. But Henry, we saw him go from, I think it was about 46% at some point through the night, down to 42. So you can see that that didn't help him when those came in.
And on that note, you know, as has been talked about throughout this campaign, we've not had a governor up from up there since Carol Campbell. I think there's going to be a lot of regional pride playing into this over these last couple of weeks. There are going to be a lot of folks up in Greenville that want to send one of their own to the governor's office, and that is a massive portion of the GOP primary electorate. That those are some of the voters who are most likely to turn out again 2 weeks from now. So that could be, you know, the make or break at this point.
And yeah, and McMaster's campaign is coming out swinging. They just announced a major six-figure media ad buy statewide today, but I'm guessing they're going to be just probably living in the upstate for the next 2 weeks, right? I mean, I can't imagine them dedicating much time to other places that they don't necessarily need to based on what they saw over the results last night.
Unless, you know, if they want to drive turnout in other parts of the state, you know, again, if McMaster's team believes that it's going to be hard to really cut into Warren's margin in the upstate, maybe they'll focus instead on turning out all of his supporters from other parts of the state. Trump remains overwhelmingly popular out in the PD among Republicans, and as we saw, you know, at Carolina Country Fest, you know, that's a popular spot as well. I think folks are going to be all over the place over the next 2 weeks. Certainly, there will be attention in the upstate. What I will say is the 4th District congressional primary runoff will also factor heavily into this. I mean, there's going to be a lot of folks turning out up there in part because of that race.
Yeah.
So that's even further going to increase, you know, the importance of the upstate and potentially could give a big boost to John Warren. So that's very helpful to them to have that runoff going on up there.
And then, I mean, can we just talk about what happened there, I guess, with Templeton? I mean, we have been talking about it for weeks going in there. But for, you know, the past year, we could say, she was always number two polling, was right on Henry's heel with fundraising. She raised $3.5 million in individual contributions, had $1 million on hand to go in the race. You look at John Warren, he only raised $237,000. Sorry, $237,000, but put in his own $3 million. I mean, so they were kind of right there, but she had some of that major support going into that momentum, and then we saw it disappear because that Warren money, that messaging, and we saw Shauna Adcox with the Post and Courier report the other day that a lot of people were kind of turned off from her advertising and voted against her and voted for John Warren instead. I mean, can anyone speak to maybe what we saw happen there with that switch in tune?
Yeah, sometimes it is tricky in the last couple of weeks, especially when you've got a field this big. You know, there is going to be some duking it out that happens necessarily among the lower tier candidates, which is exactly what we saw. But I talked to some voters who in particular were turned off by the tact that Templeton took in the last couple of days toward John Warren, negative campaigning. She ran out with a TV ad that they were flagging really big as, in his own words, these are just things that John Warren has said, and listen to them carefully, and there's some things that you're not going to agree with. But what those ads lacked completely was context. They featured John Warren saying, you know, it should be someone's choice, but he wasn't talking about the choice between having an abortion or not.
Yeah.
That was in, you know, the context, if you looked at the full video, of when a woman's life may be in danger or not. So all of that goes to say there were some voters who were turned off by that, who, you know, wanted an outsider, wanted somebody who perhaps wasn't as steeped in politics as Henry McMaster or some of the other folks on the ballot, but they don't like when they feel like they're not being told the whole story. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, there are some voters who are just going to see that and be like, oh, well, he's, you know, he's for abortion, I don't like it. But anyone else who's really, you know, paying that close of attention is going to read into it. That didn't seem to help her in the last couple of days.
I mean, also the timing of the way this campaign worked out over the last year and a half.
Yeah.
She got into that race very early. And she immediately told voters for the next year, effectively, that the most important thing you need to do is elect a conservative outsider. And then someone got into the race in February who was more of an outsider than she was. Mm-hmm. And she tried to come back into the middle and kind of say, well, you know, you want an outsider, but someone who has government experience as well. And, you know, I think that if they had started at the same time, that hybrid might have worked. But yeah. The problem was people felt that it was – people seemed to think it was a little disingenuous to say, oh, you know, to kind of back away from that outsider and say that we need some kind of in-between here. You know, she was never running in that first year as if she was going to have another – major challenger to Master. She was really running like it was going to be the two of them, and I think she had every reason to suspect it would be.
For sure.
And she had, you know, the Proud of the Confederacy moment. She had some controversial things that happened over the course of this campaign. Yeah. She just did not foresee that she was going to have a serious competition on her hands for that runoff spot. She thought it would be a contest of, could I get him to a runoff, not whether or not somebody else is going to be really heavily competing with me.
And there was big campaign staff changeover too in her campaign as well.
There was. I mean, throughout, it was a tumultuous campaign throughout. I mean, she went through probably three or four different cycles of campaign staff. She did kind of settle in over these last few months of the race, but that always does make it a little bit difficult, and it made it more difficult for her to truly find the identity of her campaign and to settle on one identity in her campaign. And, you know, I think the voters struggled to figure out exactly what it was she really stood for.
Well, going forward, we are going to have a runoff debate, but Templeton won't be it. And this just came out today. SCETV partnered with the Post and Courier to host the gubernatorial debates before, and now we are partnering again for this runoff debate. We have confirmed that John Warren and Governor Henry McMaster will participate in a June 20th debate from 7 to 8 p.m. from the Newberry Opera House. Now, you can check out previous debates and transcripts on SCETV.org, but that's new today, and they will be debating next week ahead of the runoff on June 26th. Again, that debate is June 20th from 7 to 8 p.m. That will be broadcast live on SCETV and South Carolina Public Radio. And if you have any more questions or comments or want some more in-depth explanations on some of the things we talked about today, or just want to keep up with our conversation, slide into our DMs on our Instagram or Twitter at SCLEDEPOD, that's at SCLEDPOD on Instagram and Twitter, or drop us an email at SCLEDE@SCETV.org. Jamie Lovegrove with the Post and Courier and Meg Kennard with the Associated Press, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Gavin.
Yeah, thank you.
In our final section, Did You Know?, we focus on one quirky function of the state, politics, or government, named after the parliamentary procedure lawmakers use when speaking to each other. Now, South Carolina Public Radio's Russ McKinney is back with some more state trivia and history. I still have yet to answer one of these questions correctly, so...
One day.
And he continues to troll me every time he comes on. Russ, welcome back, and lay it on down. What you got?
Well, everyone knows that the General Assembly meets annually in Columbia. In fact, the state constitution says that lawmakers shall meet every January. We all know that. In the State House, in the city of Columbia. And of course, before 1786, when Columbia was established as the state capital, the first capital was in Charleston. But actually, there's been a third capital in South Carolina state history, although briefly. But the General Assembly met there, the governor was present, and laws were enacted. A brief hint or a possible clue before we ask the question.
Yeah, well, I'll take it.
Okay.
It was an AT. I need as much help as I can get here.
This was early in state history, so it's been a while. So did you know, or the question, you know, so where was the capital briefly located other than Columbia and Charleston? A, Camden. B, Monk's Corner. C, Jacksonboro. D, Goose Creek.
So we got like a few down there in the low country. Camden, I want to believe. But I feel like every time the first answer is the wrong answer, and I always guess that, I think. I mean, did Monk's Corner and Goose Creek... They don't sound as sexy as Camden. Camden's pretty historic.
So you're going with Camden?
Yeah, I'm going to go with Camden.
Answer is C, Jacksonboro.
It's not even a real place in this state. No offense to Jacksonboro listeners.
It most certainly is. Jacksonboro is about, the community is 30 miles south of Charleston. It's just as you cross the Edisto River into Colleton County. It's a nice community, a lot of historic markers there. You should go the next time you're going from Charleston to Beaufort. But in 1782, Charleston was occupied by British forces. The General Assembly hadn't met in a couple of years because of war activities. But there were some very contentious issues at the time about colonials in South Carolina upset with loyalists in South Carolina and wanted the state to look at confiscating their property. Of course, property at that time included slaves. So it was a very, very contentious issue. So the General Assembly, after a two-year or so hiatus, met in Jacksonboro in a Masonic lodge and spilled over next door to a tavern, met for 2 months. The governor was there. They passed a number of bills. So at that time, Jacksonboro was the capital of South Carolina.
I should go. It's my namesake town. No offense to fellow Jacksons that live there. Well, thanks, Russ, for stumping me again, even though I'm legitimately trying to answer these questions as much as I can.
Thanks.
The South Carolina Lead is one of many ways SCETV wants to help keep you informed. Check out the latest news and live streams on scetv.org. Listen to coverage from South Carolina Public Radio and tune in Friday evenings at 7:30 on ETV for This Week in South Carolina. All of that, this podcast and more is available on SCETV's super easy to use app and scpublicradio.org. Subscribe to us and we'll have a new episode for you every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find podcasts. You can also find us on the NPR One app. Follow us on Instagram at SCLEDEPOD, that's at SCLEDPOD, where you can see photos from the studio, around the statehouse, our awesome memes, and also while we're on assignment. We're also on Twitter with the same handle, at SCLEDPOD. Email questions, comments, or your gripes to SCLEDE at SCETV.org. The South Carolina Lead is produced in partnership with South Carolina ETV, South Carolina Public Radio, and a special thanks to the Post and Courier and the Associated Press. Our producer is A.T. Shire. Sean Birch is our supervising producer. Caitlin Park is our social media consultant. Tom Posey is our executive producer. This episode was recorded and produced in South Carolina Public Radio's studios here in Columbia on June 13th, 2018. I'm Gavin Jackson. Thanks for listening.
Secret message. Guy Fieri says relax.